Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. As President Biden heads to the Middle East to reassure Israel of America's unwavering and unconditional tolerance of its genocidal persecution of Palestine and other expansionist aims, and to try to convince the murdering royal family of Saudi Arabia to reduce its oil production, which would in turn have the effect of adding upward pressure on oil prices, polls are showing that his so-called popularity is at a historic low. He would still beat Trump if a head-to-head election were to be held today, but that poll statistic doesn't include the possibility of a third-party run. The most likely third party in 2004 would be one on the right, like the Libertarians, and there would be little danger of a left third-party challenge. The Greens are virtually gone, and the Working Families Party was never really intended to be more than a pro-labor independent lobby, though in that capacity it does do excellent work. Biden's popularity polls often include a question like, are you happy with the direction the country is going in, yes or no? They lack any latitude for nuance. There is no way to say, for instance, I think the Supreme Court is destroying the Constitution and all the civil rights gains of the last 60 years, but I like the federal spending package Biden is proposing. You can't criticize Biden on foreign policy or praise some of his environmental protections. In short, I regard the polls in this instance as essentially meaningless. The polls I am watching are the ones for the House and Senate and governor's races this November, as those will determine whether the Biden administration can accomplish anything at all in the second half of its four-year term. As Biden himself said, will he be left with nothing more than a veto pen? In the balance are reproductive rights, already hanging by a thread, and if Republicans take over in November, they've already said they'll seek an outright national ban. All environmental protections. Republicans have already hamstrung the EPA and are seeking to prohibit states from restricting greenhouse gas emissions. Marriage equality, public education, the postal service, and anti-discrimination laws are all on the chopping block. So this is really momentous. The very progressive and broad-ranging Build Back Better plan was more than just an appeasement to progressives, communities of color, and labor, and if it had been able to pass, were it not for Manchin and Sinema, millions of people would already be benefiting from the renaissance it would have ushered in. But the Biden we see today is largely an impotent shell of a politician whose own party has failed to support transformative initiatives. But how do you reenlist the disaffected electorate, weary of empty promises and unfulfilled hopes and dreams, if you can't offer a proactive plan? Could that be why Democratic moderates like Ohio's Tim Ryan are relying so heavily on pointing out how much worse their opponents would be? They're not wrong about that, of course, but is that enough? Meanwhile, the U.S. is sending even more aid to Ukraine. We've already spoken about the criminal, immoral, and atrocious nature of the Russian invasion, but also about the U.S. complicity in precipitating and perpetuating that conflict. In today's show, we'll hear from journalist John Pilger to speak about the way the war has been framed in the Western media. We'll also hear a report from Al Jazeera about the looming food crisis in Europe, caused at least in part by the Ukraine war and a disruption thereof of grain exports, and also by the effects of global warming, which is intensifying heat waves and droughts throughout northern hemispheres. And lastly, economist Richard Wolff will discuss the popular myths behind the causes of inflation. We'll start with John Pilger.
When it comes to old-school journalism and investigative reporting, they don't make them like John Pilger anymore.
They bomb Cambodia, a neutral country, back to the Stone Age.
The Australian journalist, author, and documentary filmmaker has dedicated his life to the pursuit of truth.
It's called civil disobedience. Thank you.
And in a business overtaken by spin, misleading narratives, and government cover-ups, he remains outspoken and fearless.
We must be skeptical of absolutely everything.
From the war in Ukraine...
Above all, this is a war of propaganda.
...to the plight of jailed WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange...
...that if Julian goes to the United States, that will be the end of him. He will die.
John Pilger discusses it all in the latest episode of Talking Post.
John Pilger, thank you very much for joining us. Let's get straight to it. Now, Russia has invaded Ukraine. Now, if you ask me for my personal opinion, I mean, all war is wrong. All invasions are wrong. But at the same time, John, I do remember I was pretty critical as well of this invasion that was not happening. Just the buildup on the Russian side of the border, the buildup on the Ukrainian side, and then weeks and weeks of saying it's never going to happen. But it did. So what happened there?
Well, if you see it from the Russian side, without taking the side of Russia, it looks rather different. There was Russian troops, as you may remember, up in February, massing on the Ukrainian border, and they eventually invaded. That was the news on this side of the border. On the other side of the border, there were 60,000 Ukrainian troops who were massing on the line of contact right across Donbass. Now, Donbass, as far as the Russians are concerned, is the last stepping stone. You're close by Russia. You have a strategic advantage over Russia. Everything in modern Russian history and in not so modern history tells us that the Russians will never tolerate this, that they regard this as a threat, and they have much of their history to justify it. History is, in any discussion of geopolitics, history has to be part of one's analysis, even if it's not overt. It has to be understood. There has to be a basic knowledge of it to understand why things are happening or what is likely to happen. Our ignorance of Russia, like our ignorance of China in the West, allows none of that historical sense of how people see the threat and how political forces see the threat. This is not in any way to, if you like, condone Putin's invasion, but it has to be understood. So I don't think Russia is going to gain from this. Once you unleash war, literally anything can happen.
Is this going to be a decades-long war? Because it seems like the U.S. is determined to defeat Russia in Ukraine itself by arming the Ukrainians, by building a coalition against Russia, etc. And Putin, for whatever reason, whether it's a loss of face or whether he's determined to stay the course, I mean, that is going to go on for a long time, right? And at the same time, there's also a distinct danger, a real danger of it escalating to something that nobody wants to see.
Yes, you must remember, though, that above all, this is a war of propaganda. And I would think almost nothing one reads in the Western press about the invasion of Ukraine is to be trusted. A skepticism, or the skills of skepticism, that I'm not sure the reading public, the watching public, particularly in the United States, possesses, that is crucial now, because nothing can be believed. Every day when I scan the media, I look at the source. It's Ukrainian intelligence. The propaganda operation in Ukraine is quite brilliant. They've managed to invent a chemical warfare attack when there wasn't one. They've managed to keep out of the Western media the fact that so much of Ukraine is infested, if not run by, but infested with true extremists, fascists, neo-Nazis, they are called. The United States may be about to fight, you're saying, or to encourage a war in which it plays a leading role in Ukraine. What to remember here is the US doesn't give a damn about Ukraine. Ukraine is simply a pawn in this. But the object, as the US Defense Secretary is, and I paraphrase him, is to destroy the Russian Federation. That's been known for a long time. That is probably the most dangerous project in the world today, because the Russians are not going to allow that.
When you talk about not trusting anything that you see in the media, unfortunately, even being a member of the mainstream media myself, I have to agree with you to a great extent there because of the disproportionate coverage in this war. It's reached a stage where anything that the Ukrainians do is glorified and anything that the Russians do is vilified, to the extent now that you have mainstream Western media celebrating news from Ukraine, like dead pictures of dead Russian soldiers being sent back to their mothers. There's almost a celebratory tone in the media. And this begs the question, what happened to empathy? We're not asking for sympathy here, not asking for sympathy for the Russians as an invading force, but empathy for humans, right? For young lives, soldiers who've been sent into war, not by their choice. They follow, this is the military, they follow orders.
Well, I've spent my career working in the mainstream, and I've covered probably 7, 8, 9 shooting wars. I've never seen a coverage so utterly consumed by a tsunami of jingoism and of manipulated jingoism as this one. And that's why nothing should be trusted. I say that to people all the time. I said, unless you're going to sit in front of your television and deconstruct what you see, actually take it away with you and check it and try to verify it as much as you can. And if you can't, to discard it. Well, most people don't have the time to do that. I don't have the time to do it. Therefore, I have to say I ignore it most of the time. There are honorable exceptions. Of course there are. They're very few and far between. I mean, what has happened in my recent lifetime in the mainstream media is that, now I'm speaking about, I've spent most of my time in the British, working in the British media, in the British press, is that spaces that were there for journalists who might be called, let's say, mavericks, that is, they made an effort to tell the truth. They went against the grain. That was tolerated. When I went into Fleet Street in London, starting from the 1960s, there were spaces for people like that, and I filled one of them. Those spaces have been closed. Certainly, there is much more media, and there's probably much more opportunity. And yet, the reporting, this is probably the first war in Ukraine reported by social media. Now, that doesn't call on the highest standards of professionalism. But it does mean that at least we have a way to question what we see and hear and read in the mainstream media. The mainstream media is part of a propaganda war. That's not said or meant to be in any way agitprop. I'm speaking against the craft that, if you like, gave me a home through all my career. But that's the truth. And we must be skeptical. We must be skeptical of absolutely everything.
You've just had the Australian election. You have a new government in power now. Labour's back. What can we expect with the new government, given the track record of the previous one in terms of its foreign policy? Is there going to be some kind of change in its approach to the region, say countries like China, or is this just meet the new boss, same as the old boss?
I think your expectations and hopes must be kept at a very, very low level. I would think there is nothing to separate, nothing substantial anyway, to separate present Labour government from the last coalition government in terms of foreign policy. I mean, here we've had a good example where Anthony Albanese, the new prime minister, has just been to Tokyo to meet with Biden and Modi and others. There he had plenty of opportunity, even make a token gesture on China, especially as Prime Minister Li and others in the Chinese government had said, in effect, let's try diplomacy. But instead, he gave the world a lecture about something called Australian values. I don't know what they are. That's not diplomacy. That's playing as Australia has been doing for too many years, and that is as an echo of the United States. So I wouldn't expect much.
One of the documentaries you made some years ago was The Coming War Against China. You're talking about that. Now, given the latest situation, you have the Quad being set up, posturing, the U.S.-led coalition against China to contain China, all that's going on. And given this new government, are we still heading towards that collision course as far as the way Australia is going about it with its Western partners, the U.S.-led? Is there still a clear and present danger of us descending into something that nobody wants to see in the end?
I mean, it's very flattering, I suppose, that Australia should be mentioned in this way, because I don't think it matters a damn what Australia in the end does. It's what the United States does. Australia follows the United States. Australian foreign policy, its military, its intelligence community, its media, much of its public intellectual life is integrated into the United States. It's often a term of an insult to say Australia's the 51st state, but it is. It is what happens in Washington that matters. And in Australia, as in basically in the United Kingdom with various variations, the United States leads. And what they want, usually they get. The fact that China is surrounded by some 40 US bases, all the way up from Australia, new bases in Australia, all the way up through the Pacific, across to Asia, up to Korea and Japan and Okinawa, floating in bases, all aimed at the industrial heartland of China. That is never mentioned here. It was never mentioned in the election campaign. It's never mentioned in the media. Instead, we have periodic outbursts about China's assertiveness in the South China Sea. So, there has been a sort of what they like to call now, I hate this term, but a soft war already being waged against China. That's what we live with day after day. It's extremely dangerous.
So let's talk about Julian Assange, basically a political prisoner being held on trumped-up charges. You're a good friend of his. You've been in touch with him. Now, we all know the political row over Assange's imprisonment and the fate that he's being subjected to. But can you give us an idea from your personal interaction with Julian? Give us a sense of what's happening to him as a man now, as a human being.
Well, I have it through his wife and others. I haven't seen him for about 18 months in prison. But I'm always, when I have seen him, I have been astonished at his resilience. I don't know how the man has kept going, but he has. But at some cost, as we know from evidence in the court case. And I don't think there's any doubt in my mind, as there is no doubt in the minds of his loved ones, that if Julian goes to the United States and is effectively dropped in a penal hellhole, that will be the end of him, literally. He will die. Anything is better, of course, than going to the United States. But the torture, and it's not a word I use idly, the torture he's suffered has cost the man terribly. If Julian is extradited to the United States, I think it will effectively end real independent investigative journalism. Who will take that risk again? If the United States and other countries, but if the United States mainly, can reach anywhere in the world and take a journalist for writing something or revealing something it doesn't approve of.
So one of the most egregious, outrageous aspects, if you will, of this case with Julian is that he's an Australian citizen, but Australia has made no effort whatsoever to protect one of its own. But the new Australian Prime Minister, is that just lip service? But he did say that enough is enough, something needs to be done. He said he doesn't agree with what Julian has done, but enough is enough. So is there a chance now that there may be something, that Australia will try to do something?
I think it goes back to your original question about Australia and China. And that begs another question. Will Australia deviate from the United States? In my view, no. Anthony Albanese has said enough is enough. I think I quote him, this has gone on too long. He doesn't mention the fact the man has committed no crime. And this is a journalist fighting for his life and for the right of real journalism to publish the truth about governments. But he said nothing since. Many have appealed to him. Julian's father, John Shipton, has seen him and personally appealed to him. John Shipton has appealed to all the prime ministers that went before that. I appealed to Malcolm Turnbull, the prime minister two ago, that this was an Australian responsibility. The man is an Australian. Does nationality mean nothing? Well, apparently it means nothing, because Australia has not only done nothing, it has colluded with the United States to keep Julian where he is.
John, how do you carry on? How do you not feel like giving up because it's just hopeless? I'm not just talking about Julian, but in terms of the kind of journalism that you do. I see people attacking you. I see people calling you a pink or commie, that kind of stuff. How do you carry on?
Well, that's an old one, a commie. My goodness. The great journalist James Cameron once said, if they call you a communist, especially a communist dupe, then you'll know you're doing something right. You're succeeding. Look, I could ask you the same question. Ask any good journalist how they carry on, because they believe in journalism.
I feel like giving up a lot of times. I feel like giving up a lot of times.
Well, sometimes I felt like giving up, but I have such a passion for journalism. It's addictive. It has been addictive all my life. And I believe it is so important. And when you're faced with of the day after day examples of the worst kind of journalism that isn't really journalism at all, then I think that's only further encouragement to keep going. People, we have a responsibility, journalists, to our audience. We have a responsibility to give them as much of the truth as we possibly can. We can very seldom give them the whole truth. Doesn't happen, but we have that responsibility. And I've had enough response from audiences, my audience, television, newspapers, to understand that it works. It's appreciated. It's understood.
We'll have to bring it to an end now. It's been a fascinating chat, but I do want to continue in that vein, which is, for the benefit of our viewers, when I was a young journalist, all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, you were one of the people who inspired me. You've inspired many young journalists, and I want to tell you that all of us appreciate it a lot. You're one of the last great journalists of our times, one of the last great truth-seekers, and I wish you many more years of that. People like you make the world a better place by speaking the truth without fear and favor, and long may that continue. Thank you so much.
It's very nice to hear. Thank you, John. My warm regards to you and to your program. Thank you
very much.
The U.S. and the U.N. have imposed crippling sanctions on Russia, or so we're told. Yet those sanctions are partial and permeable. Grain and other foods are excluded, and there are loopholes for Russian oil and gas, which Europe is far more dependent on than is the U.S. At the same time, a great many nations, including China, have not recognized the sanctions at all and are trading with Russia quite normally. So why then would there suddenly be a food crisis in Europe related to the invasion of Ukraine? Russia blames the sanctions, but the European Union blames Russia for blocking Ukrainian exports. We have next a report from Al Jazeera on the looming European food crisis and its causes.
Hi, I'm Femi OK. Today on the stream, three stories in the headlines from around the world. In the United States, the January the 6th hearings are underway, but can the in-depth investigation of the attack on the US Capitol influence public opinion? And in Nepal, a former child actor and model went public with her story of rape and sparked a movement to overhaul the country's antiquated sexual assault law. But first, to the war in Ukraine as it enters its fourth month.
The war in Ukraine is not over, so it makes it very complex to see what will be the final outcome of this humanitarian catastrophe, which is very urban, making it even more complex to identify those in need and provide humanitarian assistance, as we would traditionally do in other countries. We're still noticing a lot of internally displaced seeking temporary, medium to long-term housing, having lost everything and unable to secure their winter, basically the very harsh winter season that starts as soon as October. This year, we're looking at disrupted school year, disrupted health care, while CORIS is covering the basic needs of the eastern and southern parts of the country when it comes to providing mobile medical services, as well as covering the needs for food and temporary shelter. It is a very complex environment that also looks at disrupted agriculture, overall economy, and the impact on the population that will be very hard to sustain.
With us now is Al Jazeera's Charles Stratford from Kyiv. Charles, you have been in and out of Ukraine telling us the story of the war as it unfolds. What are the differences that you're seeing each time you go back, each time you do another story?
I think the main difference, certainly this time, and bear in mind that we haven't been east yet, we're hoping to go in the next couple of days, is just still this immense sense of shock that this has happened to the people that are bearing the main brunt of it, which are in the east of the country. We were at an IDP, an internally displaced people's centre today in Mariupol, in Kyiv, people who had left, fled Mariupol, speaking to people there. Yes, as I say, just still unable to really come to terms with exactly what had happened. People who describe the bloodshed, having lost loved ones, and family members, some unable to still locate family members, lost in the panic in leaving that besieged city. Interestingly, also speaking to a psychiatrist there who has been dealing with some of the most traumatized of these people, she said something that was very telling indeed, and something that I don't think we really talk about that often, which is this complete kind of disjunct or disconnect. Yeah. Between people in Russia with relatives in the east of Ukraine. This psychiatrist saying that she had been displaced in 2015 during the fight between separatists and Ukrainian forces in Donetsk. She had moved to Mariupol. And in the beginning days after the invasion, was in contact with her relatives in Russia. And these were her words. She said that they were telling her not to panic because, in their words, the Russian forces were coming to liberate them. I mean, it's this incredible disconnect. Sense that complete disconnect.
Yeah, yeah.
And as I say, I mean, just one of many stories, thousands of stories that you hear in covering this conflict.
If I may, on Instagram, there's another story that really hits home to me about what war means for Ukrainians. So here you say you visited this Russian Orthodox church in Ukraine in February, just before Putin's invasion. Was utterly exquisite. The front line has encroached closer and closer since then. Just going to click through it. And then that final picture is just stunning. What are we seeing here?
Well, this is part of a Russian Orthodox church complex in a town called Svetohirsk, 17th century Russian Orthodox church complex. Absolutely beautiful, situated on this river. And that wooden church, I suppose, is located about 4 or 5 kilometres to the north of it. And as you see in those photographs, we visited it in January, in the days, weeks just before the invasion. And it was spellbindingly beautiful, something out of a Dostoevsky novel, if you like. And so we were very shocked to obviously have seen it having been hit by shelling, an indication that, you know, nothing is unsafe, no matter the historical significance of it. According to the Ukrainian president, over 100 churches have been hit in this war so far. And what's worrying is certainly in the last 3 or 4 days, we are seeing an increasing intensive bombardment of the last two cities in the Lugansk region, one of the two breakaway republics, Donetsk being the other one. And we are getting reports now of what, according to Ukrainian sources, could be at least 10,000 civilians trapped in the city of Severodonetsk.
You got this information, Charles, from a deputy commander who you spoke to just a few hours ago.
Yeah.
So would you explain to our audience how you do that? How do you be in Kyiv and then still make sure that you're covering the story well?
Well, we're very lucky. We have a network of very good fixers and local journalists that we use. And we've been using, frankly, since the last 8 years, since this conflict really started, obviously 2014, 2015. So we are very well set up as a network. And this is a deputy commander that we're in contact with inside Severodonetsk, who has been stationed there for, we understand, a few months. And, describing a very worrying situation, as I say, for around 10,000 people still there. What's important to recognize, though, Femi, is that these 10,000 people, it's impossible to verify as to whether they actually want to leave. We try and bring in all voices, obviously, as we cover this conflict. And one must recognize that there are a lot of people in that area, in that region, that were very sympathetic to Russia, to Russia's aspirations, people who associate with Russian culture and Russian language. So it's difficult to be able to gauge as to how many of those estimated 10,000 people are unable to get out because of the severity of the fighting or literally are unwilling to get out. But a very worrying situation, especially in and around a chemical plant, the Azov chemical plant in that town, where we understand around 500 people, including at least 40 children, could well be sheltering.
All right, Charles Stratford. I'm just going to show Charles some of the most recent reporting, which has been at a grain silo in Ukraine. It's here on my laptop, which gives us an idea the ripple impact of a war in Ukraine, where when we started covering this 4 months ago, we were not necessarily thinking of doing agricultural reporting at the same time because of the lack of wheat and grain from Ukraine and Russia that is able to get out into the world. You can follow Charles's extensive reporting on the war in Ukraine by going to aljazeera.com. Charles, thank you so much. Our next story is about rape, and I want to give you a moment so that you have a chance to walk away from the screen if you need to. In Nepal, activists are calling for swift justice for victims of sexual violence.
The current provision is grossly restrictive and unmindful of the state of survivors and victims of sexual and gender-based violence, and it does not factor in the stigma and the trauma that they go through. The Nepal government should consider amending the provision of a one-year statute of limitation for a period of time that is sufficient and proportionate with the gravity of the offence. This is also a real opportunity for Nepal government to revisit its rape laws and look at them holistically and bring them in line with the international human rights standards, especially ensuring gender-neutral references in the law.
In a series of TikTok posts, a now 24-year-old model and actor says that she was attacked 8 years ago by a beauty contest organizer who also took photos and videos of her and then went on to blackmail her. Now, this has sparked a widespread conversation on sexual violence in Nepal. Joining us from Kathmandu, Deshan Lama is a human rights lawyer at the Forum for Women, Law and Development. Deshan, this is a really disturbing story, but it's not an unusual one for Nepal. What is unusual is that the young woman has come out and told her story. But the story goes back to 2014. Could you briefly tell us what happened?
So, thank you, Penny. In this case, first of all, it's a unique case because as you said, that this case was the survivor herself came out through a social media. She was viewed by millions of people, youths, human rights activists, lawyers, and so many people, like layperson. So she was herself who was defining all the horrendous thing that happened to her, the torture, the rape, sexual abuse for a longer period of time, like more than, like for 6 months, continuous 6 months, she was abused. So she was the one who was telling the stories from her own mouth. So this is a unique case in the history of Nepal, and this is definitely a landmark case that would definitely change the, you know, the laws of sexual violence. It would cover the loopholes of the sexual violence laws in Nepal.
So Deshan, we are looking right now at some of these TikTok revelations from Sushmita, and I don't understand everything that she's saying. Obviously, she's not speaking English and all of these. Can you explain the impact that her looking at the camera, telling her story, what that had in Nepal? What did people do when they saw this?
So when people saw this video, when it went viral, like, so all the people were very shocked because, you know, she was defining she was defining all the, you know, the horrifying thing that happened to her, like the continuous torture, rape, and she was psychologically broken. She was frustrated, you know. She kept quiet for all these long years, for 8 years, and she tried all the things. She went to psychologists, psychiatrists, counselor, and, you know, the most important thing is, like, she was not aware of the 1 year time limitation, statute of limitation. Mm-hmm. So in the next videos, like, she took help from all the high profile people, but you know, very unfortunate that she couldn't be helped or she
right.
couldn't.
Let me just recap for our audience who are outside of Nepal so they understand. If you do not report or file your rape case within 1 year of that attack happening, it's too late. Is that the case, Deshan? So it doesn't matter at what point after 12 months, it's too late.
Yeah,
her
right,
case
right.
won't be taken in the court.
Yeah, right. So as per the, you know, the National Criminal Code of Nepal, the statute of limitation to file the rape case is like 1 year. So if
right.
the limitation is crossed, then unfortunately the case wouldn't be taken. But in this case, you know, all the human rights activists, lawyers, you know, parliamentarians, they really supported, like, all the people took in the street to protest and in the parliament. Right after the incident went viral in the parliament, the lawmakers, you know, registered the motion to, you know...
What are the protesters asking for? What do they want to happen?
The protesters are basically asking for the justice to, you know, remove the time limitation of that has been addressed in the sexual violence law. So basically they're asking for justice, for the safe environment for the women to walk, you know, irrespective of anything, like, to be safe. So they just want the justice for the survivors.
Is that possible for the law to be changed? Obviously, any law can be changed. But the pressure of the mm-hmm. protesters, the story that came out on social media of this horrendous rape, and also the alleged rapist has other mm-hmm. allegations against him. So that is really mm-hmm. serious as well. It means that the perpetrators may well go unpunished. What is realistic that may well happen that changes sexual violence law in Nepal?
Definitely, Penny. Definitely, the law. We are very hopeful that this time the law would be changed, because I'm not saying that all the previous cases were insignificant, but, you know, this time, like, already the bill has been, you know, registered in the parliament. So the parliamentarians are very serious about, you know, extending the time limitation. They are themselves demanding to, you know, extend the time limitation or remove the time limitation. So definitely, the writ petition has been already filed to extend the time limitation. Six female lawyers filed the writ petition to, you know, extend the statute of limitation. So definitely, it will definitely change bring a very historic change in the sexual violence laws of Nepal. Considering the responses from everyone in the, you know, whether it be like social networking side, whether it be the youths, whether it be the lawmakers, everyone, like, they are coming together.
So the rallying cry,
in solidarity.
The rallying cry is justice for Sushmita. We need justice. Me too. so many ways that the protesters are saying, you need to pay attention to us. What has happened to Shushmita? Where is she right now? And how has she reacted to the impact that she has made?
So also keeping in confidential, keeping, you know, the her status of mind and confidentiality. So actually, Forum for Women and Law, Forum for Law and Development, FWLD, assisted her to file the FIR in the police. So initially, the FIR had been already, FIR was filed. Mm-hmm. It was filed under the Human Trafficking and Transportation Control Act because considering the fact that the statute of limitation has been already crossed. But then in this case, the government attorney has, you know, requested the lawyers, our lawyers, to also address the charge of rape in the charge sheet. So we are very hopeful because we have been getting a lot of support from everyone. So
thank you,
she's
Dishan.
Thank you.
We're going to leave it on that hopeful note. Thank you, because there's so much more to say. We will be following the story, so hopefully that you will come back to us as it develops. We really appreciate you being on the stream today. And now to the United States, where the January the 6th committee, looking into the attack on the U.S. Capitol in 2021, have started public hearings. The actions of former President Donald Trump have been scrutinized by a 9-member panel, and they have been tasked with investigating the deadly riots.
We need to remember that thousands of people, pro-Trump supporters, stormed the U.S. Capitol in a way that we have not seen in recent history when it comes to domestic terrorism. Over 850 people who participated in that have been charged. Over 140 police officers were injured, and people ended up dying as a result of that. People are focusing on whether or not people will actually be held accountable at the upper echelons of our government, and also thinking about other political actors who played a role in this process, particularly when it comes to conspiracy charges. We know what happened. The question is going to be, will white supremacy actually be on trial and be held accountable in a way that we rarely see in the United States of America?
Joining us now, Heidi Zhu Castro, covering these hearings for Al Jazeera. Thanks for joining us, Heidi. I know you've been doing live hits all the way through the day. I was watching early on this morning, and it appeared to me to be an apology tour by the Trump administration. So some of the things that were happening behind the scenes, and we were watching the news thinking, that is really strange. Why would President Trump say that? And then we get to hear all of the things that were happening behind the scenes, and some very bizarre things were happening, Heidi, right?
Absolutely. But, you know, if this was an apology tour, Femi, it's the kind where your mom grabs you by your ear and yanks it and says, you have to say you're sorry. Because I will say, this compelling footage we've seen of the behind the closed door testimony, that's happening because those witnesses are under order legally to, you know, they swore their oath to answer these investigators' questions. So it's not an apology tour so much so as a reckoning.
To. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Interesting. Right. Out of what you've heard today, what struck you? Rudy Giuliani was drunk giving advice to the president. That stood out for me, but then that made so much more sense as to his behavior for much of the rest of the time, during the time that he was advising former President Trump. Thoughts?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was being that fly on the wall, right? Even though these are like conversations about what had happened, but just pretend that you were there within the White House residence. And it was described in vivid detail, kind of the sensation of being among Trump's closest advisors and his daughter, who just had their hearts sinking as the returns were coming in on election night, especially when Fox News, you know, called the race in the state of Arizona, the key swing state for Biden, for the challenger, and how everyone just were disappointed. But they said when they went to Trump, he was livid that he had lost Arizona. He would not accept that. And he would only turn to his apparently, according to witnesses, his inebriated attorney, his private attorney, Rudy Giuliani, who said to everyone, you know, he has to go out there in public and just say that he won, even though, you know, evidence would show otherwise.
So we're getting the behind-the-scenes drama, which is fascinating. This is the inner circle of President Trump. I am wondering who is being appealed to here. Republicans, Democrats, the whole of America. What are your thoughts there?
Well, this committee is certainly hoping to appeal to all of America, and I'm sure their wish list is to speak to the Republican voters, but that is a tall order because, as we know, the opinions about what happened on January 6th and who is responsible has been so baked in among the greater American population for this year and a half that I would say very few people who already think Trump, you know, should not be blamed for January 6th, I don't believe their minds would be changed. And almost everyone you ask would say the same. But it is interesting. You can argue people are overall interested, though, Femi, because we know 20 million Americans tuned in to the opening hearing last week. That is a pretty high number. I mean, it's like Sunday night football, which is really big here in the U.S.
That's huge. Just got here. U.S. TV audience for January the 6th hearing reaches 20 million. So that's a pretty big audience. I am also thinking out about there are moments that have been really fascinating for an audience. If you are a President Trump fan, it probably makes you feel like, okay, he was in charge. It was all down to President Trump's decision. And if you weren't a President Trump fan, it basically confirms the idea that he probably wasn't fit to be a president in the first place. What are you hearing from, are we hearing from Republicans watching their own give testimony?
I think many Republican leaders are trying to just pivot away from all of this. When asked, they normally shift the conversation deftly to Biden and how they say he's not, you know, taking care of inflation, for instance, because all are aware here, and this gets to your question about the greater purpose and who they're talking to. There's an upcoming midterm election where the congressional majority is at stake here in Washington in November, and Republicans are hoping that this set of hearings, which are certainly creating huge headlines, does not invigorate the Democratic base, which is, of course, what Democrats want. So it's everything has to be viewed through this partisan lens. And of course, although the committee here would not say that political motivation has anything to do with it, reality is there's an election coming up and everyone wants to play to their voters' favor with this.
Do we know, Heidi, what is coming up next? Do you have a program of events or program of speakers so you know who's coming up so you can watch for, oh, that might be interesting, I'll watch that particular person at the hearing? Is that possible? Does the public and do journalists understand what the next part of the hearing will be?
Yeah, we're getting drips of it. We get a little knowledge like the day before, for example, who the witnesses are. But bigger picture, the committee here has laid out Trump. They say evidence will show that he had a 7-part plan in lying about the outcome of the election, trying to get it overturned, and then assembling the mob and trying to reap the benefits. So we've seen them go, yes, last week's was kind of the opening argument. Today was focused on the beginning, the election night loss. And going forward, there's two more hearings this week, and we've been told that they will focus on Trump's attempt to, in the committee's words, corrupt the Justice Department, and when he failed to do so, how he assembled the mob, which they say had the intent of an attempted coup in trying to keep Trump in power, essentially, by force. So very strong arguments, and they've laid it out in a very systematic manner over the course of these half dozen or so hearings.
Heidi, thank you so much. We will continue to watch you reporting live from Washington, D.C., giving us the latest on the hearings and all of the developments. You can find them also on AlJazeera.com. Now, if there is a story that you want us to cover, it's really easy to get to us. We are at AJStream on Twitter. That's AJStream on Twitter. Thank you to Charles, to Deshen, and to Heidi for being our guests on today's show. I will see you next time. Take care, everybody.
Economists have warned that a recession is looming on the horizon, but what are the real reasons, and might at least a portion of the downturn be manufactured? Here to discuss this question is economist Richard Wolff.
When the price goes up, you're getting the same box of cereal you got last week, last month, last year, before the price went up, but you're now giving more of your money for that box. That means you get the same amount of cereal you used to get, but you give up more money. And from the point of view of the employer, who's clapping his or her hands, they're giving you the same box of cereal, but they're getting more money out of your pocket. In other words, an inflation moves wealth from the buyer to the seller. That's what it's for. And they know you might be angry about that. You might decide that you are being, here we go, ripped off. You might be even more angry if there was an honest explanation saying to you, we just raised the price of the shoes, of the blouse, of the hamburger, of the box of cereal, because we want to make more profit in this company. That might make you upset because you'd be confronted with that reality. It's bad for you to pay more, and it's good for them to get you to do it. So the capitalist class, when there's an inflation, becomes a very loud about scapegoating somebody else. You see, that's helpful to them. They want us to believe that they didn't raise their prices to make more profits or to protect the profits they already were earning. No. They only did it because they were, get ready, get your handkerchief, forced to do it. And let me give you some examples. Here's the very popular one. We wouldn't have raised the price, you know, we employers, but we had to. Really? Why? Well, the workers were getting or demanding more wages. So we had to raise our prices to cover the higher wages. And we wouldn't have done it if it hadn't been those awful working people who demanded more. This is almost always a lie. It would be a lie right now, and the way to explain that is very simple. Prices are rising in this country by 7 to 8%. Average wages are rising around 5.25%. So obviously, even if there is some grain of truth to the notion that you're paying higher wages, you're jacking up your prices well beyond all of that. So let's be honest. Moreover, workers have a hard time getting higher wages. They usually use the argument, our prices are going up, please give us more, but they have a clear problem. The employer may decide not to agree to that, and then what do? In the private sector of our country, less than 7% of workers are in unions, so they can't strike. The vast majority have no union. Those who do have a union have another problem. Most unions have a contract with the employer that covers wages for 2 to 3 years. You can't raise them in that period. So even if prices are going up, you have to wait for the contract to expire 1, 2, 3 years from now before you can even ask. And it's not at all clear that you will get. So blaming the workers, that's a cheap shot, cheap out, most of the time, very minimally relevant. Here's another one that's really popular these days. There have been disruptions in the supply chain. All right, let me translate that into English. Somehow, goods are not getting through, and so they're scarce, you see. And if we all want them, but they're scarcer than they used to be, those who have some of these scarce items to sell can and will jack up the price. But we shouldn't be angry at them, you see. They're just taking advantage of some disruption in the supply chain. Calling it a disruption in the supply chain is cute. It is a way of focusing people's attention on something else. We can be reminded that there was a big freighter stuck in the Suez Canal a few months ago, and we saw the funny pictures, and maybe that has something to do with it. Well, my answer is, let's not be naive. every businessman and woman knows that if you can restrict the supply, that then becomes a way to force up the price. All the people who want whatever you're restricting the supply of will compete with one another, bidding up the price to get whatever is scarce. You can pretend that all the scarcity is a force of nature. It just happened. I don't know how it would happen. It just a disrupted supply chain. But that naivete is really silly. We have a supply chain disruption because it's profitable for the sellers of goods to use scarcity to jack up their profits by raising their prices. And then there's the one I like the most. I call it the libertarian ploy. Libertarians are very, very, very useful to capitalism because they blame all of its problems on the government. This is wonderful. It allows a business to kick its workers, and the workers get angry, not at the business that kicks them, but at the government. It allows a bank to throw you out of your home because you haven't covered your mortgage, and you get angry at the politicians, not the bank that evicted you, not the corporation that fired you. It's remarkable. And true enough, the libertarians come through. And why do we have an inflation? They want us to believe the answer, the government. And not just the government anywhere, but the government that runs the money system, the Federal Reserve, our central bank. And so they love to tell stories about how the central bank has been pumping money into the economy, which is true, and that that money is now enabling prices to go up. That's true, too, but it doesn't face a simple fact. The Federal Reserve has been pumping massive amounts of money into the American economy every year since the year 2000. That's 22 years. And we only have an inflation this last year. We didn't have it the other 19. So pumping money is clearly not the cause. Something else has to explain it. And I think I did. There is very little likelihood that this inflation is going to go away anytime soon. The Ukraine issue, the sanctions, if they have any effect, they will disrupt the global economy in a variety of ways. That will, if the past is any guide, make it more likely that prices will be raised by companies confronting disruptions in the global economy. I think we're going to see every business in the world take advantage of all of this turmoil, use it as one of those convenient scapegoats so they can get away with raising prices when it might have been harder to do so. We are already seeing companies position themselves so they can raise prices by suggesting they've taken this or that hit from the Ukraine problem and so on.
That was Richard Wolff, host of a weekly podcast, Economic Update. I'm Evan Davis, and I hope you've found the perspectives here challenging and thought-provoking, or at least informative. I'll be with you again at this time for another edition next week of Conscious Voices here on your community radio stations, WCRS LP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRN LP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. See you next week. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.